I'm Evan Kleiman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW. Would you consider eating a piece of bread that's over 100 years old? You do every time you eat good sourdough. More on sourdough's aged mother today. Speaking of dough, fried dough can't be beat. It's the donut, and I'll tell you why it's so American. How do you save a variety of pig from extinction? Eat it. I'll explain. First, let's see what's coming up for harvest at the area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We have caught up with Jean-François Metinier. He is the chef at La Cachette, and he has a cart pretty well fully loaded, and it's only about 9:30 in the morning. Jean-François, yeah. You are on a mission. What are you shopping for today?
Well, I'm getting some the first heirloom tomatoes. I mean, they're starting to look, the yellow ones especially, are very sweet. And I have the tiny little eggplants here.
And what color are those?
Purple eggplants.
Purple, white, stripy.
Yeah. The first one I saw them, I took them.
Very small, like the size of a very large thumb. Yeah.
Yeah, and we serve them with the fish.
Delicious. Yeah.
We actually take the skin off and we roast them, and they are absolutely delicious because they have very little seeds inside. It's all meat.
And they're so easy to grill whole if you want to just grill them whole. All right, Jean-François, all that sounds so good. And tell us where your restaurant is.
It's on Little Santa Monica, west of Beverly Glen.
Okay, La Cachette.
La Cachette.
We're visiting now with farmer Ed Munak from Paso Robles. Ed, we've been waiting and waiting for you to get here this year. And you've got a table full of fragrant melons. I can smell them from about 10 feet away. Can you tell us what you got here?
We have Ambrosia, which is a orange flesh melon. Really our number one melon.
Looks like a cantaloupe. It's got the netting. Yeah.
It's real musky and everything. And we have the Rocky Sweet, which is a green melon. I think it's one of the sweetest green melons you can find.
It's a green flesh, but is it that one with the yellowy skin?
Kind of yellow, but they're really green inside.
And you got some watermelons down there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, we have two kinds. We have the seeded ones, which are called sugar babies. And then we have the seedless. The reason we have the seeded ones is we have to have some way of pollinating the seedless because they're all female flowers on those. And we have to have a male to pollinate it. So,
some people say that the flavor of a melon with seeds is actually better than the seedless.
They ferment around the seeds, mm-hmm. And it develops more flavor.
Now, can you eat watermelon seeds? I've heard of people that just chew them up and eat them.
I saw a woman who looked like she had swallowed a watermelon seed.
That's
she
called liked, being pregnant.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's not the same. We're not going to keep that myth alive.
Anyway.
Now you stay till we get the first hard freeze. You're here till Thanksgiving usually.
Usually.
Yeah. And you come to the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica and Sunday. And that was Ed Munak. He's an organic farmer from Paso Robles. He has the heirloom tomatoes. He'll be bringing many, many more varieties. All organic. Another thing you can do with watermelons is take them home, scoop the entire contents out, dice it, put it in a freezer bag in your freezer, and then when you're ready to make your watermelon margaritas, instead of putting ice in the blender, you take your frozen watermelon cubes and your tequila and your lime juice and whatever else you want to add, blend it all, and it not only makes a non-watery margarita, it's a fine slush because you're pureeing the watermelon itself. It's delicious. And thank you, Robin and David, for that recipe. Next Thursday, July 20th, the Santa Monica Farmers Market is going to be sponsoring its first of three library panel series. They're going to take place at the Santa Monica Public Library, which is at 6th and Santa Monica Boulevard. It's going to feature Russ Parsons from the LA Times. It'll feature Evan Kleiman and farmer Phil McGrath and farmer Marianne Carpenter. We're going to be talking about the future of farming and the future of farmers markets in California and how farmers markets have helped farmers stay farming. For more information about this Thursday's library series and for the series in general, go to kcrw.com, keyword good food. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
There's been a little controversy floating around the champagne world recently. Maybe you haven't been paying attention, so I need to let you know that the drink of choice amongst moneyed hip-hop stars, Cristal Champagne, is out. Hip-hop artist, label owner, and mogul Jay-Z has called on a boycott of this brand of bubbly because the company president has expressed little enthusiasm for its most notorious fans. Apparently, Jay-Z has chosen an alternative, but just in case it's not up to his liking, I thought I'd call in the knowledgeable folks at Wine Expo in Santa Monica for some alternate suggestions. On the phone with me this morning is Robert Rajness, General Manager of Wine Expo. So first, tell me what the big deal is with Cristal.
Well, it actually predates the hip-hop thing. Cristal went from being just another really good champagne to being the currency of the realm in the entertainment business back in the 70s when Playboy did an interview with Joan Collins. And as a throwaway question at the end, they asked her what it would take for her to sleep with a particularly onerous producer that everybody knew at the time. And she said laughingly, a case of Cristal. And the next day, it was the coin of the realm. People were sending it around as jokes. And within a year, we were talking about tagging them like dolphins so we could see how many times they were regifted. Then the hip-hop people discovered it. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that it's the sweetest champagne you can buy that says Brut on the label. It really tastes like cream soda or something. It's really rich, really full, fruit-driven, not dry, and astringent, and the British taste, as they say. Plus, the bling factor of the packaging was always good.
For those of us who have never seen a package of Cristal, describe this bling.
It's the wine itself is a beautiful translucent gold. It's put in a clear bottle, which used to be made of actual crystal when the champagne was originally made for the Tsars of Russia. And so it's a clear glass bottle, and then it's wrapped in orange cellophane. And the general effect, especially if backlit, as you often see in videos, is pretty striking. It looks like a jewel.
So what is the retail price of a bottle of Cristal?
Well, it's interesting. The wholesale price in L.A. is higher than the retail price in the Midwest because of the exaggerated demand here. But generally, if you can get some from the real actual rotor distributor, you could sell it for $180 or so. Plus, it's a lot of stores, and especially restaurants and bars, just charge ridiculous premiums. I mean, you can pay $700, $800 a bottle for it in restaurants and clubs around town, no problem.
That is just unbelievable, a $600 or $700 profit on a bottle of wine.
Well, that happens in really nice steakhouses where all the customers are balding guys with cigars with Harlan Cabernet, you know, so demand is demand.
So do we know what Jay-Z picked as a replacement?
Oh, yeah, he went immediately to Krug, which is a pretty good choice from a quality point of view. I think a lot of his friends and fans might not dig it because it's very, very dry and very structured and much more of an adult taste. But Jay-Z, despite being, you know, a notorious rapper, is a very cultured multimillionaire entrepreneur, and I'm sure he's been exposed to a lot and has advisors.
So what do you think this is going to do with the sales of Cristal? Do you think they're going to see an actual measurable dip in sales?
Not at all. There never was enough to go around. It'll just go to different places. Krug is up quite a bit already. There will demand to suck it up, if nothing else, in China and Russia. But there's plenty of people that want Cristal. But there's wonderful alternatives for less money.
So before we get to those alternatives for less money, what would you have chosen not so much for Jay-Z, for his personal consumption? What do you think would be comparable to the accessible flavor of Cristal?
Well, what we always give people ask for Cristal, both because it has similar flavors, but also because it comes in a clear bottle with an even cooler label that looks like a stained glass window, is Vimar Cuvée Creation, which is an extremely rare champagne made from biodynamically grown vines, all barrel fermented, and there's like literally hundreds of cases, not tens of thousands of cases. And we've got great stories to go with it, so it's a no-brainer.
Give us a couple of those stories.
Well, my favorite is we have a customer who's a Latin R&B singer, and he was invited to the Universal Latin Music New Year's Eve party a couple years ago. And he took a bottle of this. The next day, his girlfriend, who's Puerto Rican and talks like Rosie Perez, calls me up. She says, Robert, it was great. We opened our bottle after the Cristal, and it was like in The Wizard of Oz when it went to black and white to color. You can't beat that for a tasting note. You know?
And give us an idea of the price points of the two.
That's under $100 when you can get it. We have it more often than not. A few other places around town have it. But it's something that literally in one day there's more Cristal consumed than there is produced of that wine. So you have to source it.
What about some other bubbly suggestions for those of us who don't really need the status symbol but want a really good value?
If you want something big and rich that's delicious, one of our favorite go-to things is another grower that has pretty good production. numbers called Margain. And you can get their non-vintage Brut for $40, and it's rich and lush.
Give us one more before we say goodbye.
Sure. I think for a lot of people who are used to the richness and lushness of Cristal, if you have a big party, a really good Prosecco, which can be had for under $20, would be a good thing. But back to Champagne, another producer that we love a lot is Angeline Godel. They're a Grand Cru producer in Ambonnet, which is a famous village in Champagne, and they make a Blanc de Blanc Grand Cru for $41. It's beautifully creamy and smooth, and everybody likes it.
You are so great, Robert. Robert Rajness is the general manager of Wine Expo on Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica. There's some great people there to help you with all your wine needs. Check them out sometime. So it's still before noon. Let's talk about donuts. Fried dough, delicious and sugary. Just talking about them right now makes my mouth water. The rise of the donut in American life. Excuse the pun, when Good Food returns. Donuts get a bad rap. In just a few years, they became the symbol of bad eating. But who can resist a donut? Hot and sugary, filled with delicious jellies, or cake-like and covered in chocolate. They belong with a cup of coffee. Are donuts a distinctly American thing? John T. Edge knows the answer. He's a noted food historian and director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. The Alliance explores and records Southern culture and is located in Oxford, Mississippi. John's a frequent guest on Good Food, and I always love to check in with him on any topic that strikes his fancy. Today, it's all about the donut. So, John, if it's such an American story, since we borrowed everything from everywhere, where did they originally come from?
In some ways, to Americans, it doesn't matter where they came from, though you can make an argument for Dutch origins of donuts. You could also make an argument that fried pastries, fried doughs, are universal. From the Zeppoli of Italy on down through numerous cultures. What America did, though, in our inimitable way, we kind of streamlined the donut. We commodified the donut. We sold America on this idea of a puff of fried dough, shellac with sugar, and a cup of coffee. We sold that as something that somehow stood in for American largesse, for the American dream, for America itself.
And how important do you think it is in terms of, in modern times, in modern lore of the donut, is the policeman's embrace of the donut?
I think it's deeply important. In the suburbs of Boston, I met a guy named Paul Berry, who runs a place that is, in essence, a one-time donut shop that has morphed into a policeman's supply house.
You're kidding.
I'm serious as I can be. Of all the people I've met researching these books, he may have been my favorite. Paul is a very sweet man with a very vulgar mouth, and I say that with great admiration. He cusses well. And he has this place called Doughboy Police and Fire Supply in Kingston, Massachusetts. And it really did evolve or devolve from, you know, from him setting up a shop selling donuts. He realized a lot of his customers were policemen and firemen, and the donut business was sagging, and before he knew it, he was storing, you know, police boots in the walk-in and hanging up belts and blackjacks where once the coffee cups were. Pillsbury tried to shut him down because he used the, you know, an equivalent of the Pillsbury Doughboy on his card. And he told me, he said, some firm with 19 names on its letterhead called me from New York. And then he began cussing. So he didn't cave in to them, though. He still uses something that looks kind of like the Pillsbury Doughboy on his card, and he still peddles police supply.
What a great story. What about the wars? Did the wars and these canteens where lovely lassies were serving refreshments to servicemen. Did that sort of do something to solidify donuts as a comfort food and an easy way to sort of make a date and have a chat?
Yeah, I think the point at which donuts become American, I mean, I think you can really peg that to World War I and to the efforts of the Salvation Army, specifically the Salvation Army lassies, who were the women who ministered to the troops when they were in the European theater. You know, the women are behind the lines. It's more difficult to bake pies, which would have been the first instinct of kind of ministering to the men by way of food, bake them a pie. It's easier to set up a contraption and fry donuts in a vat of oil. Some stories go so far as to say they were, you know, in an overturned helmet. I think that's going too far. But there's this great, the American War Cry, which was the magazine of the Salvation Army. There's this great song, and I'm not going to sing it, but I'll read a couple of verses. A donut's just a donut, boys, till you are over there. And day and night, you're in a trench away in France somewhere. You get a fresh-made donut. Seems it comes from heaven above. That donut, boys, reminds you of a slice of mother's love.
Well, that's quite wonderful. Did you find in your research that there are regional differences in our love for donuts? Do Southerners prefer a different type than we on the West or those of the Northeast?
I found some regional differences. I did not find as strong a regional difference as I did, say, with hamburgers or fried chicken. What I did find, though, was that, say, in New England, you're far more likely to see cider donuts because of access to cider. Out in California, I came upon what to me seemed like the perfect kind of California variation on the donut in a guy named Jim Nakano, who runs a place called the Donut Man in Glendora. Jim, when strawberries are in season and also when peaches are in season, at his little donut shop, he will serve basically a holeless jelly donut, just basically an orb of fried yeast-raised dough. He'll slit that open and he'll lay inside that freshly picked strawberries. And when I mean freshly picked, I mean that morning those strawberries were on the plant at about 5. Jim is picking them up from a friend who runs a farm down the road. And by 6, they're in your donut, sliced and glazed, laid inside the donut. And the same thing happening with peaches when they're in season.
Now, I have to backtrack just a minute. What is a cider donut?
It's a donut. It's a cake donut with the liquid therein. The liquid mixed in is apple cider. So it's got that kind of whang of apple cider to it.
Oh, they sound really good. You know, John, as always, it's just so lovely to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Evan. Thanks for asking me to come on.
John T. Edge has just finished the final book in his series on American food. The latest is called Donuts, and it follows hamburgers, apple pie, and fried chicken. You should check out the Southern Foodways Alliance, which he directs, too. The link is on our website at kcrw.com, keyword, good food. To make donuts, you need bread. And to make bread, you need a mother. I'm not talking about the woman who birthed you. I'm talking about the source for all fermentation and flavor. Mothers have to be fed and taken care of. I'll tell you about one that's over 100 years old. That's next on Good Food. From time on this show, you hear us talk about wild yeasts. It could be in relation to cheeses or to brews or maybe even breads. The most familiar, of course, to all of us is probably sourdough. Sometimes we hear that a friend has made their own starter from grapes, and it seems all an incomprehensible mystery. To take some of the mystery out of this type of wildness is Dan Girado, Director of Bakery Operations for San Francisco-based Boudin Bakery. Boudin was established in 1849 and is the creator of the original San Francisco sourdough French bread. So, Dan, I understand that you have quite a familial pedigree when it comes to pushing around sourdough.
Our mother dough, our starter, it dates back to 1849.
That's incredible.
Some people think it's a mystery of how it happens. Every day we have to feed our mother with flour and water. Flour and water makes the mother dough grow. After 24 hours, you might have a small piece of mother dough that grows into a very large piece.
Let's go back to the beginning. When you say starter, what is it that you mean by that?
It's part of one of our ingredients for our sourdough bread. It's what gives it the unique flavor. All different sourdoughs have different starters. A lot of people have gone to artificial starters by using vinegar and other ingredients, but the natural way is to do your own starter.
So you
it's a long process, obviously.
Yeah, so you create what you call the mother by allowing wild yeast to gather.
Yes. What makes our bread and our mother so distinctive is the spores that it picks up from in the San Francisco area, because San Francisco is such a unique climate. It has a lot to do with the climate of San Francisco and the fog.
So when we talk about the mother, are we talking about a big slushy mass, or are we talking about something that's firm, like what we think of when we're kneading bread?
It's something firm, but once you open it up and you smell it, it's something very, very sour.
Wow, how interesting. So every time you go to make your bread, you use some of this mother, and then do you also use additional commercial yeast?
No, we don't use any commercial yeast. We just use the natural yeast.
Wow, and you've kept this thing alive since 1849.
Since 1849. There was only one period of time where we came close to losing it. It was in 1906 when we had this big San Francisco earthquake and the fire. But Louise Boudin, who was the wife of the founder, rushed into the bakery and saved some mother dough and put it on ice until she was able to move the bakery to a new location.
Now, I understand that your great-grandfather was the original baker for Boudin.
He wasn't the original baker. He became the master baker in 1935. He was an immigrant from Italy, and he was able to purchase the bakery in 1941.
Let's go back to this mother, because I find it just so intriguing. What mass of mother do you keep on hand so you can bake the enormous amount of bread that you do?
Well, I can't tell you all the details because it's a secret. There's an art of making sourdough, and there's only so much you can tell, because everyone wants to know how much mother do we put in, what are the percentages, what temperature do we keep the mother at. It's all part of the
mystery.
Part of the mystery and part of the secret that only a few of us know, hopefully.
And does it ever gather any off strains of yeast, or does it just stay within this one flavor profile?
Well, we have bakeries outside of San Francisco. We just opened in South Coast Plaza in Orange County, and we're going to be doing baking on-site. And in other climates, the mother takes on a life of its own after a couple of weeks, because it takes in the wild spores or the wild yeast from those areas, because the air is different. So every 3 weeks, we have to ship a load of mother dough from San Francisco to all these different places to refresh the mother and make sure to get it back to that original flavor.
I mean, I think that's what San Francisco quote San Francisco sourdough is sort of all about. That's what everybody expects, is that really extreme sourness.
It is very extreme, and you get the golden brown crust with the what people like to call either fish eyes and bubbles, which really show the distinct San Francisco sourdough look. And once you cut into it, you'll know the distinct sourdough flavor.
As a sort of fallback protection, given the nature of our state of California to fall prey to various disasters, do you have any mother stashed in remote locations?
We do.
God.
In all of our different locations, we have our mother handy. The only natural disaster is if California sank, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Dan, it's really been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
That was Dan Girado of Boudin Bakery. We've been talking about the mother that they used to create that fantastic San Francisco sourdough bread. If you want a good summer project, try making your own mother. Nancy Silverton has a great one in her La Brea Bakery bread book. A warning, though, the list of ingredients is really, really long. Another foodstuff that's hundreds of years old is pork. Many different varieties of pig used to roam this country. One variety, the red wattle, is almost extinct, but there's one way to save it from this fate. Eat it. The story of the red wattle and what's being done to save it next on Good Food. There's quite a bit of concern these days on eating not only sustainably, but ethically, particularly when it comes to eating animals. But when does eating animals become the absolutely ethical thing to do? Perhaps when to do so would actually increase the population of endangered breeds. It sounds anti-intuitive, but with me this morning is Patrick Martins of Heritage Foods USA, a business which supports and markets heritage livestock breeds. And just last night, we celebrated the voyage of a breeding pair of red wattle pigs who are on their way to Napa to lead a lovely life of repopulating their breed. What is a heritage breed?
Well, heritage breeds are breeds that are traceable back for centuries within this country. And another condition of a heritage breed is that they're raised according to certain protocols.
We're talking about livestock breeds. We're talking about animals that have been bred in the past for eating.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are entire species that exist on this planet in the numbers that they do because they're food. For instance, pigs. No one really uses pigs for anything other than food. A lot of people think that when we eat a food, like when we eat pigs or when we eat turkeys, that they're all the turkeys and all the pigs that are raised are actually killed and eaten. But there's about 10 to 20% of them that are set aside as breeding stock. So, for instance, the two pigs that we're traveling with are going to die of old age.
Let's use these little pigs that we were talking to and enjoying last night, the red wattles, as an example of what it is you do. Share with me a bit where the breed came from and how many are left in this world.
Well, there's definitely a lot of mystery behind the whole history of the red wattle, but to the best of our ability in the libraries that we visited, it appears that they came to New Orleans in the 19th century via New Caledonia. And, you know, for the next 80 to 100 years, there were a few family farms around the U.S., mainly in the South, that raised the red wattle for food. And then at the very end of the 19th century, the breed was actually thought to be extinct until a wild herd resurfaced in the forests of Texas. Now there's just about 3 or 4 farmers in the United States that raise the red wattle. And there are less than 300 breeders left. So the two that were at the restaurant last night were two of the last 300.
Now, what is the gastronomic profile of the red wattle that you found so extraordinary and one reason why it should be repopulated?
Well, most pork that people eat, you know, isn't very well marbled. It's very white meat. It has very little fat. The red wattle, which has won most of the taste tests we've ever conducted with chefs, is a red breed. And when you eat it, you know, it's red inside. And it excels in its hams and in its pork chops. It has a very high marbling content, and it's just very succulent. It just tastes a little different.
Now, I know you're on a tour right now that you've dubbed the 40 Days and 40 Nights Tour. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, we knew that there were all these family farms that were raising, you know, livestock, you know, heritage breeds that we worked with. And we knew there were all these chefs that were paying more money than they would usually, you know, to source these foods from small family farms. And we said, why not visit them? Why not create a documentary? So there's 4 of us, and the 4 of us have been in the van for the past 35 days.
With the pigs?
With the pigs for the last 7. But we've cleaned out the the cage a lot, and part of what we're doing is a trip to celebrate what's happening right in the food world. And I think a lot of people are too dire about what's going wrong in industrial agriculture and GMOs, but there's an entire beautiful story being woven by the truckers of this country, by the small family farms of this country, by the chefs and the home cooks. And that's kind of the story we wanted to tell. And the way we're going to do the documentary is, you know, tracing a pig from farm to table, but also to follow a pig's journey from Kansas to start these two satellite flocks in San Diego and Napa.
These two little pigs that I met last night are part of these satellite flocks that are going to be happening here on the West Coast. And the reason for making satellite flocks, what would that be?
Well, you know, there's this saying, you never put all your eggs in one basket. And so you never want an entire species to only be in one little place. You want to spread the genetics. And there's a huge food safety thing about what we're doing. You know, Evan, you might get the flu, but I might not. I might have the genetics to avoid a flu. And so you always want to make sure that you don't only have one type of turkey, one type of pig, one type of chicken. And with the industrialization of the food supply after World War II, that's essentially what's happened. And you find all the biodiverse genetics on the brink of extinction. So we really try to save these genetics. We think a safer food supply is a more diverse food supply.
What is the role of the family farmer in all of this heritage livestock?
What's beautiful about these heritage breeds is that their, you know, future depends entirely, it falls entirely on the shoulders of the small family farm, because just by their very nature, heritage breeds resist industrial agriculture. They're too smart, so they don't like staying in one place. They run around. They're playful. They don't fatten up very quickly. So, you know, they're everything that industrial agriculture is against. And so who's going to raise them? Who's going to fulfill this huge market and this huge demand that's growing with restaurants? It's really going to truly be the responsibility of the small family farmer.
So if consumers are interested in learning more about the breeds that you and Heritage Foods USA provides, and if they're interested in purchasing, is there a website they can go to?
Sure. There's a few. I mean, ours is heritagefoodsusa.com. We actually might change our name to Authenticity Found, which is right now our tagline. But we believe in finding authenticity, not trying to create it.
Patrick, it's been really a pleasure having you in town for these couple of days, and a really special pleasure meeting those two little red wattles that I saw last night. Take care.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Martins from Heritage Foods USA. You can go online to heritagefoodsusa.com and take a look at what they're doing and what kind of breeds they offer. A great way to prepare pork is to brine it first. In fact, with today's lean pork, brining is essential. For some tips on the difference between a marinade and a brine, here's Jim Tarantino, author of Marinades, Rubs, Brines, Cures, and Glazes.
The major difference between a marinade and a brine is that a brine uses salt, where a marinade uses acid, and they have two different types of effect on the food that you're marinating, or brining.
What are the different effects?
A marinade is a drying effect on food. It's not adding as much moisture into it as people think, where a brine will retain moisture.
Is that because of the salt, just like we in our bodies, if we eat too much salt, we retain water?
That's part of it on the brine side of things, but on the marinade side of things, the acid in the marinade actually will draw moisture out of that particular part of the surface. Now, you're going to get a feeling of moisture on that surface by the added addition of oil, which actually binds the ingredients to the surface of, let's say, a piece of chicken, fish, or meat.
So we want to use a marinade then primarily to add additional flavor, and we want to use a brine primarily to add additional moisture.
And flavor. Because actually what you can do with a brine is you can brew it like a tea and add additional ingredients to it.
Give us an example of that.
Well, let's take it for example. If you wanted to, let's have a citrus-style brine, and you're going to use this maybe for a pork chop, turkey, or chicken. You could literally brew the rinds of orange, lemon, and lime till they flow to the bottom, create a tea. And that will infuse the brine with a citrus-style flavor.
Now, when you say brewing, I always think about hot water. Are we doing this in hot water or are we doing this in cold water?
We're doing this in hot water. Absolutely. The first thing that you really want to do in a brine is to dissolve the sugar. And sugar really dissolves over high heat. Sugar is usually used to offset the saltiness or taste that you're going to feel in your tongue.
Oh, that's really interesting. I always wondered why people added sweeteners like honey or sugar to brines.
It's flavor management.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. So we basically want to take all of our ingredients and heat them together to dissolve them and intensify the flavor and allow for an infusion.
Exactly. And you want to brew it for about 30 minutes or until the hard ingredients flow to the bottom. It's one of those IQs that we will look for in cooking.
And then we, of course, have to allow it to come down to room temperature, or do you even recommend chilling it before actually putting our meats in the brine?
Oh, I recommend chilling it. It should be around 32 to 40 degrees. And the food that you're putting into it should be around the same temperature. If it's not, what the problem with that is that it'll retain too much salt, and you'll really have a salty product when you're finished.
Well, Jim, those were really great tips for brining. Thank you very much. That was Jim Tarantino, author of Marinades, Rubs, Brines, Cures, and Glazes, talking to us about brining. My next guest is ready to save you from mundane eating. He thinks we spend far too much of our waking lives worrying about chores and not enough about eating. He's a self-named Epicurean desperado. I'll find out what that means next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Okay, if you had the knowledge that you eat 22 tons of food over a lifetime, and you use 16% of your waking life preparing food, would you approach your eating experiences differently than you do now? Meet Stefan Gates, gastronaut, a man who lives to maximize our excitement to mastication ratio. His book, Gastronaut, Adventures in Food for the Romantic, the Foolhardy, and the Brave, is a hilarious look at a different kind of extreme eating. Stefan also has a new TV series, Cooking in the Danger Zone. It's a series of culinary travelogues filmed in crisis zones around the world, using food to discover the world and its people. You've described yourself as an Epicurean desperado, willing to cook and eat anything at least once. Do social ethics ever cloud your choices?
The social ethics are the reason that I want to do these things, to be honest. More importantly for me, it's a way of getting beyond the palate and through to their minds to give people extraordinary experiences through food. And there are certain things that are admittedly very difficult for people to eat. I did a film and I went to Korea to investigate the dog meat industry. And I really wanted to eat dog, but it became incredibly complicated because it's an unregulated industry that where some dogs are very well kept and some dogs are, frankly, badly abused.
So I'm curious to know, this experience you had in Korea with attempting to eat dog, was your own just taboo about eating a pet? Did that come into play at all?
Well, I kind of went out with a real gung-ho approach to it. I fully expected to just throw myself into the culture and to, you know, when you're in a different country, you sort of take on a different set of approaches to things like food and society. And so I thought that I'd just steep myself in Korean society and dive into a big steaming plate of dog meat. We met a lot of different people. We visited dog farms. And there is this incredible feeling the first time you walk into a dog farm. I always think that you should be, if you can eat a pig, you should be able to eat another animal, whether it's a dog or a cat. The reality is you walk into a dog farm and something smacks you in the face and it all seems really scary and quite wrong. And so suddenly you're thinking, these are really cute and they're wagging their tail at me. A pig doesn't do that.
Okay, now we should say that not all of the food experience that you talk about in your book are of that level of extremity. For example, you talk about gold plating food. Now, this is fascinating to me. I didn't know you could gold plate an object that is as so soft and has so much moisture as food does.
It works incredibly well. I had to do a lot of experiments to get it right. If you wipe off most of the grease from a cooked sausage, but just keep a little patina of grease on, then you roll it over a piece of transfer gold leaf, and the gold leaf just stays on the sausage. And it's one of those things that, on one level, it's entirely pointless. There's no taste in gold. It's completely inert. It passes straight through your body. It gives you no calories whatsoever. And yet, by gilding a sausage and giving it to your friends for supper, you're creating this strange magic. It does make dinner into a strange sort of transcendental experience.
It's so interesting because it's as if you play with outrageous, extreme beauty and unexpected moments of food experience to sort of make one stop.
A lot of what I try to do is to push food into a sort of an emotional zone. There's a recipe for head cheese, which is basically brawn. It's a pig's head boiled for 3 or 4 hours, and then you strip all of the meat off it. And in basic terms, that's a pretty simple operation. But it's actually a whole tale of guilt and redemption, because you go to the butcher's shop and ask for a pig's head. Everybody around you raises their eyebrows. And then when you get it home, you open it and you do feel this incredible sense of guilt. And then you start thinking about how important the head is to a pig and how tragic it would have been to have just thrown that away. So you're kind of showing some sort of gratitude to the animal in a sort of strange, fractured way. And you deal with concepts of things like death, which is extraordinary, which you never get when you eat a sausage.
Okay, now let's go from these deep thoughts to one of your recipes, which is called a bum sandwich. Now, is this a sandwich that we would pass out to the homeless here?
No. This is in Britain, bum means bottom. It's basically a sandwich that you make and then you sit on for an hour, and you have to make it with lots of relatively wet ingredients, things like avocados, pesto, and you cover it with lots of olive oil, and then you wrap it up in lots of plastic and put it in a plastic bag, and sit on it. There's the pain bagnat in France, which is basically a hollowed out loaf of bread filled with Niçoise salad and then compressed and left in the fridge with lots of oil for a couple of hours. And I suddenly thought, well, what about using the human body as an oven? And so you use your own body temperature to bring this sandwich up to 37.5 degrees, and you compress it. And it's a little bit like, I don't know, when you were a kid, if you had sandwiches in your bag when you went off to games, and you'd sit on your bag. And I remember getting my sandwiches out and they'd been sat on, and I quite liked them that way.
It's sort of like a low-tech pressed sandwich.
Exactly. It's like having a sandwich griller, but just a gentle one. And I recommend using a pregnant woman's bottom for it. My wife was pregnant when I was writing it, and her sandwiches were always the best. It's always a little bit tricky when you start sharing them. They're great for kids to keep kids in one place during supper. And they have to sit on their sandwich for an hour. It's quite difficult getting through the whole hour. But when they get them out, everybody's sharing them. There's a little bit of tension in the room. Because nobody knows how well their bowels were working the day before. But it's a lot of fun. And again, it's just sort of taking things that we normally do and recipes that already exist and just trying to find a little bit of tension to it and trying to push the boundaries a little bit further. And I guarantee you, you try this and you have an extraordinary experience.
Stefan, you are a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Gastronaut is the name of the book. Stefan Gates is the author. He's got a BBC series that begins this week called Cooking in the Danger Zone, Hopefully, we'll see it on BBC America sometime soon. It's July, and it's National Ice Cream Month. So who better to talk about eating ice cream than that man who always tells us we eat too much? Next, some ways to enjoy ice cream without overindulgence. That's when Good Food returns. If you don't know that ice cream is my favorite food group, then you haven't been listening very closely to this show. So I'd like to pose a question. Is it possible to have a long-term relationship with ice cream and still be healthy? In order to answer this question, I turn to Dr. Will Clower, medical researcher and author of The French Don't Diet Plan and The Fat Fallacy, Applying the French Diet to the American Lifestyle. Is it possible? Is ice cream banned for our lives?
Oh, no. And who would want it to be? Ice cream is a good thing. As a matter of fact, you know what's funny? Is that recently, medical research has been providing a lot of data that support the role of dairy in actual weight loss.
Now, I've always wanted to ask somebody this. Were they underwritten by some part of the dairy industry?
Exactly. And that's part of the problem, is that when I look at their data are completely clean. And it seems like the effects are real. However, most of the studies were underwritten by the dairy industry or the makers of Yoplait yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of controversy there, although other groups are now starting to confirm and reconfirm those initial studies. So, for example, another group, this is just in the Journal of the American Medical Association, showed a relationship between dairy consumption and the prevention of insulin resistance syndrome that is involved with diabetes and all of that.
Have they isolated a chemical reason for why this would be, or is it related to the satiety factor that dairy products give us, so we end up eating less?
That's a great question. Actually, the proposal is that it has to do with calcium and that the mineral balance of calcium in your body can affect the fat burning capacity that you have. One of the things that they've looked at is supplementation with calcium. And when you do that, when you supplement with calcium and you keep all the calories the same and you control for everything, what you find is you still get more weight loss when you supplement with calcium, but you get even more when you have dairy. And one of the things that shocked people when you talk about healthy cultures, like the French, for example, that they end their meal with cheese, you know, and they have yogurt every morning. And so they're having full fat, saturated fat cheese twice a day, every day. And it's the stuff that makes you moan out loud, Evan. It's wonderful stuff. And these are thin, healthy people. And it may be that it's the calcium. It may be it's the protein, which is also, like you said, a satiety factor.
Is there a person that we can go to that is the, quote, inventor of ice cream?
No. You know what? Iced cream has been around since Nero. This is the first recorded instance of ice cream, and it's like in the 4th century B.C. But the first American ice cream recipe is by the same man who wrote the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson.
That is so great.
There's a great lithograph of this recipe where you can see it, and they have the little translation. It's wonderful to hear what he has to say about it. He was a very big gourmand, and he actually brought this back from France in one of his trips to France. Now, again, iced cream has been around, but I think what he brought back that was novel was the custard nature of it, which is uniquely French. Jefferson, in fact, this is so funny, he had an ice house just for his ice cream. And he had capacity for 62 wagon loads of ice. He was eating a lot of ice cream. This man knew what he was doing.
That this is a man after my own heart.
I love him.
Right. Now, for those of us who might eat too much ice cream at one time or too fast, and we get that sort of famous ice cream headache, what right. causes that?
You know what? It's actually a model for migraine. And it's they think that it comes from very similar mechanisms. There's a group of nerves that's in the upper palate region in your mouth. It's called the sphenopalatine ganglion. These nerves go up into your brain, and they control the contraction and the dilation of your blood vessels. And when that thing gets cold, it shuts off the control, and it makes too much blood go through your little vessels, and you get this knife in your head for about, on average, 10 to 20 seconds. The neat thing, really, is that in one set of studies that are on ice cream headache, what they found was that 93% of those who got ice cream headache also suffered from migraine.
Wow, that's so interesting. Is there something we can do if we get ice cream headaches? Is there some sort of like putting our tongue in some part of our mouths, breathing through our mouths?
Yeah.
What can we do?
You can do that if you've got ice cream headache. You know, the data are, I can't believe how many studies have been done on ice cream. The data are that it peaks within about 30 seconds, but it only lasts 10 to 15 seconds. So you could just, you know, you wait it out. But the best thing to do, Evan, is to prevent it, not to treat it. So the way to prevent it is to make it last as long as possible.
Make the ice cream last as long as possible.
If you get the ice cream headache, this is the universe telling you that you need to spend more time with your ice cream, not less. Do you know what I read? The average number of licks to finish a single scoop of ice cream? Guess.
Gosh, the average...
Average number of licks.
I'd say a couple hundred.
I know. It's 50.
It's 50?
That's not nearly enough. Somebody's got some big licks going on.
50? That just doesn't seem like enough.
I know. I know. See, these are people who are definitely eating their ice cream too fast.
This has been so much fun. Thanks, Will.
I know. Thank you, too.
For tips on how to eat small and stay lean without sacrifice, go to Will Clower's website, willclower.com. And to celebrate indulgence, let's go out to eat. Next on Good Food, a visit from our own culinary explorer, food writer Jonathan Gold. For me is Jonathan Gold, and you know what that means. It's time to get this wonderful writer of many LA Weekly counterintelligence columns to share with us his latest finds so we can go eat there in the next, oh, I don't know, hour or so. Where are we going? Chinese or Latino?
There's more than that in Los Angeles, but we happen to be going to a Chinese restaurant.
Perfect.
In the ever-loving city of Monterey Park.
Quel surprise.
This is a restaurant called New Concept. They have a lot of different dishes there. It's creative Chinese cuisine coming from the Chinese point of view rather than, say, Chinois, which is a European chef taking some Chinese ideas with him. And it must be said that when this restaurant opened a year ago, I just hated it.
Why?
Because a lot of the new dishes were dreadful. Like, one of the signature dishes is something called fried prawns with oatmeal. And the dish is fried prawns with oatmeal.
Imagine that.
Yeah, you have the prawns not salted or anything, but like deep fried whole in their skins with their heads and everything, like you would have in the salt and pepper shrimp dish, served with a big pile of toasted oatmeal. And there's probably some sort of synergy that's supposed to go on between the sort of like toasty, oaty flavors and the flavors of shrimp shell. But it was really unpleasant to eat. he does a foie gras, a Chinese foie gras dish that has a certain cat food essence to it.
Oh, nice. So now after a year, you decide to go back, give it another try?
I did, because people have been saying such nice things about it. And I'd had such dreadful meals. And this time around, I had some of the old dishes that I didn't like, which were just as awful as they were the first time I had them. But I had some of the more traditional Chinese dishes, and they're actually quite, quite good.
Okay, so what should we eat when we go to New Concept?
You will not be surprised to hear that one of my favorite dishes there is the braised bacon with chili, which comes topped with like a handful of toasted garlic, sort of an arrangement of Chinese broccoli above it. And Chinese bacon's a good thing in general, but this is really good Chinese bacon.
Is Chinese bacon cured with Chinese spices, number one? And number two, are we talking about strips of bacon or are we talking about a slab?
It's not a slab, but it was a slab at one time. It's been cut up and, you know, vaguely Chinese spiced. You know, the smokiness comes out and the sweet Chinese spice thing comes out. It's been glazed slightly, so it's a little bit sweet. They've got deep fried bean curd that's really nice. It's like almost multi-textured in its crunch. There's what seems to be a signature dish, which is asparagus wrapped with bacon, fried, and served with what they call corn cakes, which are cakes, like fish cakes made with pounded cuttlefish that have corn kernels embedded in them.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It's a tasty thing. There's a decent version of minced squab in a lettuce leaf. They do it with minced clams, and it's pretty highly flavored, and it's fresh, and it's good. Their barbecued meats are good, you know, really nice roast pork, really nice duck, really good chicken. And as far as price goes, if you order off the menu, you're okay. When you start to venture off the menu into uncharted waters, you should probably ask. They once asked me if I would like some steamed fish. Yeah, sure, I'd like steamed fish. Steamed fish is good. They brought out something they said was a tiger fish. It was possibly the best version of Cantonese steamed fish that I've had in Los Angeles. I mean, the meat was just, you know, beautiful, barely set, almost custardy. And the bill came, and it was close to $100 for a pound and a half of fish, which is to say really good, really expensive. If I'd known it was going to be that much, I think I probably would have sucked every single bone individually.
Okay, tell us where we're eating and the address.
It's the New Concept Restaurant, and the address is 700 South Atlantic in Monterey Park. They also have fantastic dim sum ordered off the menu if that's what you want in the mornings.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Get more Jonathan Gold each week in the LA Weekly. He's the author of the Counterintelligence column. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter at kcrw.com. Click on Email Updates to subscribe. For info on the show today, go to our website at kcrw.com, keyword good food. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. Today's show is produced by Marina McLeod, Holly Tarson, Priya Finnemore, and Bob Carlson. Thanks to Tyler Adams and Connie Alvarez. Also to Gary Masiha for the music and Reed Rudy for voice work. I'm Evan Kleinman. Please join me next week for a fresh edition of Good Food.